It's time for the new and the next. Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Ozzy, and each week he joins us to talk about what is new and what is next. Welcome back, Carlos.
Tess, good to be with you.
So let's start with my least favorite subject on earth, shall we? Math.
Don't say that, Tess.
Oh dear. Well, I think I'm not alone in my feelings here, but you found a French mathematician who is trying to spice things up.
He is. His name is Cédric Villani, but he's popularly referred to as Math's Lady Gaga. So he dresses like a 19th century aristocrat, wild, colorful, plumy shirts and other sorts of things. But he's an incredible mathematician. In fact, he won the highest prize in math called the Fields Medal, which some people say is like the equivalent of the Nobel Prize for math, but gave it all up a couple of years ago and said, I want to spend my life popularizing math with the Tesses and the Carloses of this world.
Fair enough. I do have to ask with the Lady Gaga comparison, can we safely assume that he knows the old rule that before you walk out of the house, you do some subtraction and take one thing off?
You know what? He's not about subtraction. He's all about addition. I love your pun. So as he gets ready to come out with a book next year called The Living Theorem, he's going to be doing a lot more over here in the States.
So he wins this big prize, but he decides he wants to make the world love math. Where did that transition come? Why did he decide that he wanted to become essentially a math ambassador?
Part of it had to do with his family upbringing. So he grew up in a small town in France, son of philosophers and composers and artists. So his own turn to math wasn't immediately predictable. And he found that as he tried to discuss his work with family and friends, they often had an immediate wall up, not dissimilar test from your feelings when the topic first came up. So he thought there was more he could do. And whether he did that through speeches, through new workbooks, he often pairs up tests with a comic. He thought he had the ability to kind of really bring it alive in a very exciting way.
So if only I had had a comic book in fourth grade, I could be a mathematician.
Tess, there's still time. You could always start late.
Fair enough. I'll start studying this weekend. Okay, so we've done math. We might as well bring in some science here. If you've ever had a fascination with microscopes, you got a guy to see.
So there's a young Stanford professor named Manu Prakash, 37 years old, realized the number of infectious diseases, particularly in developing parts of the world, like malaria, where 3.5 billion people are at risk of it. In terms of determining that they have it, the big gating item is often access to a really good microscope. That a really good microscope often costs $200. It's bulky. It doesn't work in remote villages. And so he came up with a 50-cent microscope, which he calls the foldoscope.
Foldoscope. And just how big are these things? How do they work?
It looks like a colored piece of cardboard that ultimately folds into something as thin as kind of a big bookmark. And he's tested it in a variety of different countries and continents, and even tested its durability by literally stomping on it and throwing it out of a third-story window. The other piece is in making science education more interesting, because now for 50 cents, they've got a powerful tool that they can explore with, whereas in the past, at 200 bucks a piece, who's going to get access to that in a relatively low-income country?
Fascinating. Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Ozzy. And Carlos, I think we've done a pretty good job of getting people hopped up about science and math. So we'll get the books out right away this weekend.
Hey, the phrase of the day is STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and math.
All right. Thanks so much, Carlos.
Good to be with you, Tess.
And you can explore all of the stories we talk about at npr.org/newandnext.
President Obama and mayors all across the country have been talking a lot about how early childhood education can be an important investment in the economy. But as policymakers consider preschool for all, they're trying to figure out what actually works in the classroom. One of the places they're looking is Boston. From member station WBUR, David Scharfenberg reports.
But mine is the bigger one.
It's a Wednesday morning at the Elliott K-8 Innovation School. Teacher Jody Doyle is working with a small group of students interested in domes.
What do you think the difference is between a dome and an arch?
The lesson doesn't go exactly as planned. Doyle wants the kids to build their domes with wire, but she doesn't want to just come out and say it. The kids used wire several months ago for a related project, and she's hoping they'll remember.
Is there anything else in this classroom we could use that might hold the shape of a dome?
Teaching coach Marina Boney is watching closely. Later, she commends Doyle for trying to tie the new wire project to the old. But she says photographs of the older, forgotten project might have made the connection a bit more concrete.
You didn't have some of the documentation to remind them of the process.
So I almost had to give it to them.
School officials say this system of intensive coaching is a key to their success. It's part of a larger focus on quality. Boston uses a rigorous curriculum, and it requires preschool teachers to get master's degrees. Academics have known for some time that quality matters, but much of the research is focused on small-scale programs. This is different. Last year, a study out of Harvard University found big gains in math and vocabulary in a Boston preschool system spanning some 68 schools.
That you can develop high quality across 68 schools was not obvious.
That's Harvard economist and education professor Richard Murnane, who was not involved in the study.
We can do better in preparing poor children for school, and it can be done at considerable scale.
But not everyone is sold. Some preschool research shows academic gains fading by third grade. And critics say a program without staying power is hardly worth a big public investment. Russ Whitehurst is an education analyst with the Brookings Institution. He says the research out of Boston does little to puncture that critique. The study, after all, only measured gains over the course of a single preschool year.
So we just don't know about Boston, whether the positive effects that are talked about at the end of the pre-K year are going to be there at the end of first grade, second grade, or third grade. And without knowing that, it's hard to make a decision about whether this is a great program that ought to be replicated in other places.
But policymakers around the country aren't waiting for a long-term study. They're coming to Boston to see the preschool program up close. Recently, a high-level delegation from Seattle took the tour in a big white bus.
Many of you have noticed that on the back of your name tag is a little green or orange dot. If you have a green dot, you will be getting off at our first stop, which is...
There was a guy from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation on board. The mayor was in back. And up front, Seattle City Council President Tim Burgess.
They've done an amazing job here, and we want to replicate that in Seattle.
Still, if there was enthusiasm on the bus, there was also a bit of pushback. School board member Stefan Blanford likes the idea of comprehensive preschool, but he says there are some serious questions about financing a high-quality program. And even simple things can get in the way, like finding enough classroom space.
The school district is actually growing. Our enrollments are growing. And the issue around capacity is going to be huge.
Space and money are not just problems in Seattle. They're problems in many American cities, including Boston. This town may be a beacon for the universal preschool movement, but so far, Boston's only managed to provide seats for about half the interested families. For NPR News, I'm David Scharfenberg.
More food news now. This from Monica Eng of member station WBEZ in Chicago, who hosts a podcast called Chew the Fat. She's been asking the Chicago Public Schools for weeks to reveal what goes into their chicken nuggets, or as she calls them, food-like nubbins. When the school district said that information wasn't available from their food contractors, the station went to the Illinois Attorney General's office and filed a Freedom of Information Act request, all to get a chicken nuggets recipe, not information on government wiretaps. Yesterday, the Chicago Public Schools finally responded and supplied a recipe that lists at least 28 ingredients, even without the breading. Chicago Public Schools chicken nuggets turn out to be made from textured soy protein concentrate, isolated soy protein, hope I'm not going too fast for you to write all this down, brown sugar, salt, onion powder, maltodextrin, silicon dioxide, citric acid, potassium chloride, sodium phosphates, and oh yes, a little chicken.
It is that time of year when colleges and universities send out press releases touting which coveted commencement speakers they've snagged. President Obama will speak at the University of California at Irvine. Vice President Biden will try his best to inspire at the University of South Carolina. And Facebook executive Sheryl Sandberg will urge graduates at City Colleges of Chicago to lean in and listen. But our next guest argues in a recent op-ed that the commencement speech is overrated. Hal Wilde was president of North Central College in Illinois for over 20 years, which means he heard more than 20 of these addresses up close.
When you talk to college presidents, you'll discover that most of them regard procuring a commencement speaker as one of their most challenging, if not annoying, responsibilities. But they can't afford not to pay attention to it because there are few moments when the institution is more visible.
I mean, I can't imagine trying to please all of those parties. How do you even go about trying?
It ain't easy. I could tell you. Some schools resolve it by paying a lot of money and getting a, quote, famous person.
Right.
I don't believe in that. In my case, and I think for most college presidents, you have to come up with strategies for bringing in people. Frankly, I think almost no graduate remembers a commencement speech because it's like remembering what the preacher, the sermon he gives the day you're getting married. You're thinking about other things.
I thought that I remembered my graduation speaker, but then I actually looked it up this week, and it's not who I thought it was. So do you remember a really fantastic speech that you were witness to?
One of my favorites, Mary Schmeek, who was a columnist of the Chicago Tribune, wrote kind of a faux commencement speech called Wear Sunscreen. We called her up and just said, you know, hey, would you like to be our commencement speaker? You could give that speech, which you've never given anywhere. And she did. And it was wonderful. One of my last commencements, we had Christian Wyman, the poet, who was the editor of Poetry Magazine in Chicago. And he gave an electric speech, which began with a poem that he shouted to the audience of 5,000.
These poems, she said, are poems with no love in them.
It kind of bowled you over. He's one of these people we were able to get because we were the first to ask him. He was based then in Chicago, and so it was easy to get him. Those are the kinds of strategies you use when you're not able to pay people. You give them the honor of an honorary degree, and you make it convenient for them to come.
I'm going to tell you a couple of startling things today, and I promise you that you will forget them.
My guess is that part of what goes into whether students actually get something out of this is what they did the night before. But
not at North Central College.
No, of course not. What do you think the goal should be, given that your audience is maybe half paying attention?
I think one of the goals should be that they be brief, and they should maybe have one or two important points to make. Maybe they should be funny, but they shouldn't assume that people are going to walk away remembering this 20, 30, 40 years later.
Hal, I do have to ask if you have either given one of these yourself or if you would want to, and if so, what would you say, aside from aim for the stars and work hard?
I like that. I've written a number of them over the years. Along the way, there are a couple times when I wrote the commencement speech for the person who was speaking.
Wait a minute. You wrote the speech for the speaker?
I will not divulge the name. I will just say that in order to get someone to come, they said, well, you write the speech. So I did.
Oh, my goodness.
But, if I were given the occasion, I think it would probably quote Scrooge McDuck and maybe a couple other influential figures in my evolving philosophy of life. And I'd get in and out fast enough so that even if the audience didn't know who I was, they would say at least he was brief.
Hal Wilde recently retired as president of North Central College in Illinois, where he was the president for over 20 years, and he joined us from the studios at Chicago Public Media. Thanks so much for your time today.
It was my treat.